Welcome to the Hockey Show, everybody, here on 101.5 UMFM, Canada's only campus-produced radio show that strictly talks hockey. Happy to have you along tonight here on Halloween, everybody. Happy Halloween to everybody out there that's listening. Obviously, waiting to get out there with the kids and collect some candy and do all the fun stuff and have some fun that way. Season of the Witch by Donovan setting me up right there to get things going as we get started here on the show tonight. It's just me, Teebs, beans off with the family tonight to do a little trick-or-treating as they get themselves going. Lots of news coming out of the hockey world today surrounding the Jets. We're not going to talk about that this week because next week we got a special show. I'll talk about that in a little bit in terms of getting that going. But I do want to talk about something that's a little scary, a little concerning for a Halloween show. As things like concussions, CTE, are in the news every once in a while when a player sort of has some issues with either the law or his health or something along those lines. Tonight, I'm proud to bring you a man who has done a number of great articles on CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, on the website there, speaking about some of these men that have had a problem. And he's just released a new book. Jeremy Allingham, who is an award-winning author, journalist, or award-winning journalist, I guess. So let's split those two up. Award-winning journalist with CBC. He's an author. He's a musician. Jeremy Allingham has written a new book, which is available now in most bookstores, called Major Misconduct, The Human Cost of Fighting in Hockey. And I want to bring Jeremy's interview. I sat down with him on the weekend, just this past weekend. I want to bring that in right away. As I spoke to him about the three players that are featured in his book, Mr. James McEwen, Mr. Stephen Peat, and Mr. Dale Purinton, and some of the science, some of the stories surrounding everything that's going on with, you know, hockey and CTE and the concussion issue that's happening right now that we've seen. I got to say, reading his book, reading Major Misconduct, was a sobering look at some of these men and what they're going through. It was hard to listen to in some cases, or hard to read in some cases, especially the Stephen Peat story. Stephen was one of the toughest guys to ever play the game. He played with a number of teams in the NHL, most notably with Washington, but he was one tough son of a you-know-what, and to hear some of the stuff that's happening now in Steven's life is very tough. So I'm not going to take up any more time. There's about 45 minutes worth of information that Jeremy goes through about Steven and James McEwen and Dale Purinton and some of the CTE, the concussion stuff. I'm going to bring that to you right now here on the Hockey Show. Here is my sit-down with Jeremy Allingham as we discuss some of the stuff in his new book, Major Misconduct, The Human Cost of Fighting in Hockey. Please enjoy, and I'll be back after this interview to talk a little bit about some of the other stuff that's coming up here on the Hockey Show on 101.5. Here is my interview with Jeremy Allingham. You may not know his name immediately, but you likely know Jeremy Allingham's work at the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. His journalism work at the Canadian Public Broadcaster has included award-winning articles on topics that include the opioid crisis, the Northern Gateway Pipeline, politics at every level, and a range of articles on music and the music scene. He's an author when he's not knee-deep in investigative journalism, working on a new book, or at least investigating a new book. When he's not at his computer keyboard working on a book or a news article, Jeremy can be found on your local music venue's stage or a music festival stage where he's rocking and rolling as a singer and guitarist. Ladies and gentlemen, The Hockey Show is proud, honored, privileged, and humbled to welcome the author of the new book, Major Misconduct, The Human Cost of Fighting in Hockey, that delves into fighting, concussions, and the effects on players at all levels of hockey. We are humbled to welcome Mr. Jeremy Allingham to the show today. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm very well. Thanks so much for having me.
No, thank you. I mean, like I said, this is one of those big topics that we're always interested in talking about, and I'm just glad we can get somebody on who we can call, quote-unquote, an expert about it, because we are just two talking heads as opposed to a guy who now has done a ton of research. So let's get into talking about the book, because the book's got a lot of great information. And again, I've read the book. It's an outstanding book, Jeremy. I have to say that you've made a compelling argument for the end of fighting in hockey, thanks to the number of interviews you did in the book. I got to ask you, though, how hard was it to hear these men tell their stories about their bodies and their minds breaking down after watching them on TV or from the stands, for so many years?
Yeah, so first of all, thanks so much for the compliment and for saying it was a good read. I appreciate that. And I think that's a really great first question because as far as my journalistic career, learning about, researching, and tracking down these stories and then developing relationships with these guys has been one of the most fulfilling things I've ever done in journalism, but also by far probably the most difficult thing as well because we could start off with James McEwen, who, you know, was captain of the Kelowna Rockets, played a bit of a minor pro career in the ECHL and fought more than 200 times in his career. I found him just looking through the WHL, the Western Hockey League record books for most penalties and minutes, and I saw him near the top of the Kelowna Rockets, and then I looked him up and found him as a yoga practitioner, guitar playing, practitioner of peace. And went, wait, who's this guy? And just called him up and, ended up really forging a relationship with the guy. And, it's hard not to do that when someone opens up and tells you their life story, tells you their lowest moments, tells you about what the steel of the knife felt like against their wrist just before they thought about, ending their own life because of the traumatic brain injuries that they've suffered through a life of fighting. So, I'm still close with James. We stay in touch and he's super supportive of the book, and I really appreciate that relationship. And then Stephen Peat, as you described, I watched him playing for the Langley Thunder here in BC in the BCHL when I was 13, 14 years old, and he was a great defenseman. He could move the puck, he could shoot and score, he could, lay a big body out there, and then obviously drop the gloves too. And, Stephen was struggling when I first heard about him. I think I saw him first in the New York Times. And it took more than a year to track him down and to meet him face to face. And we spoke on the phone a few times, and you could hear some of the anguish and some of the pain. And but when I met him face to face, as it says in the book, there's a chapter called Voices. He really truly was having some very severe mental health issues, and was hearing voices and was describing that to me. And that moment, I would say, was probably one of the most challenging and difficult of my journalistic career, because you're really torn between, my power is to tell people stories and hopefully that can make a change in the world. But in that moment, you're kind of thinking a lot more acutely to say like, well, maybe I need to try and help this guy right now because this seems serious. And so I tried to kind of cut it down the middle and, basically made a few calls on his behalf. And I know I kind of hooked him up with a local counselor that he had worked with before, and so that the guy reached out to him, and I think that may have helped a little bit. But the point being, going back to your original question, I think I did really kind of internalize these moments that were quite difficult with these guys, and I guess in that way, though, my empathy for them was, incredibly deep, and I think that helped to tell their stories in a really, in a fair and compelling way. So it was tough, but I think it was worth it.
I mean, I got to say, it was hard reading some of that Stephen Peat stuff, and we'll get to him in a second in terms of the stuff that he went through. And we won't obviously tell the whole story because we want people to buy your book, Major Misconduct, which is awesome. So, but I do want to ask you, because you stated in Major Misconduct that it was actually a junior hockey game where you changed your view on fighting in hockey. You were a proponent, you loved it before, and all of a sudden it was one game that kind of everything screeched to a halt. You get that record scratch in terms of maybe this isn't so right. Do you find it hard to support junior hockey today, knowing that junior hockey fights, well, discouraged, and certainly people in your book, commissioners and public relations people have said that they discourage it. Do you find it hard to support it, though, knowing that fights are still allowed under the rules, especially like in the WHL, where toughness is still a trait that GMs actively look for in players?
Yeah, so I can tell you a little bit about that moment. I went to see the Vancouver Giants play. I think I was like maybe 25 or 6 years old. I'm 37 now, and I was totally on board. I wasn't like a big rah-rah fighting guy, but kind of went, yeah, it's just part of the game, and that's, just as many people do. Part of the game, it's all good. I watched Rock'em Sock'em growing up. It's a normal thing. It's a part of the game, and it was one of those nights. It was just like a Friday night out with the boys, a few beers, having a few laughs and a good time. And we sat at seventh row and settled into our seats, telling jokes. And all of a sudden, before the game even started, the gloves beat the puck to the ice. And, the crowd crowd rose around me and I heard that guttural thunder, and usually I would have been right there with them, but for some reason it really was an epiphany moment. I can count on one hand how many times one of those epiphanies, true epiphanies, has really happened. And in that moment, I just for some reason zeroed in on the two players' faces and I went, wait a minute, these are just kids. And in that moment had to ask myself, what are we doing? Like, what are we doing? We're 10,000 adults in a big room screaming for two children to pulverize each other's faces. And my stomach really sunk, and I actually spent most of the rest of the game on the concourse just kind of having a couple more beers and the hot dog, and then kind of was just like, wait, what happened out there? Like, that was strange. Like, not just the act of two children fighting and 10,000 adults cheering them on, but also just my reaction to it was quite foreign. So that was the moment. But I can't watch that. Like, I have a hard enough time maintaining my NHL fandom, but it is true that, like, the fighting's down quite a bit in the NHL, and I've watched parts of at least six or seven games this year, and I think I've only seen one fight. So, I mean, that's a little bit palatable to me, but the fact that they're kids, I think, is really a huge problem. And for me personally, you know, my old man went to see the Vancouver Giants. I know it was actually a friend of mine texted me from the Giants game, and he said, hey, I brought four kids from my hockey team to see the Giants tonight, and there were three fights, and you should have seen the kids' faces. He's like, it really upset me to see the way that they kind of, you could just see them learning that this was something that was okay. And I think it's a real problem. And like, another problem too is I interviewed plenty of junior fighters for the book and for the initial radio series that the book kind of was born from. And the level of education they had on chronic traumatic encephalopathy and other traumatic brain injuries was really, really, I mean, I was going to say bad, but like, it wasn't even bad. It was wrong. Like, they had been, either they learned themselves or had been led to believe that this was kind of something that didn't really happen very often. It was a rare thing. One guy said, it's sad to see it when it happens, but you know, it doesn't happen very often. I'm not worried about it. And then another guy told me, he was the leading fighter in the WHL for 2 years in a row. And he said, I got a pretty hard noggin, so I should be fine. And I'm going like, guys, like where is this lack of education coming from? Like, you'd think that the teams and the leagues would take, you know, some level of responsibility to inform these children that if you do this, these are some of the things that can happen. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't go to junior hockey games. That's a huge, huge deterrent for me. So, you know, I obviously think junior hockey has a lot of value, and obviously it's important to the continued success of the professional level of the game. But I mean, if you look at the stats, fighting in the NHL is down to, like, I think it's one every 5.5 games, something like that. But in junior, the rates are almost twice as high as that. And you go, okay, well, if you're preparing the young players for the pros, then I guess what you want to do is prepare them for the type of game that will exist at the professional level. So then why are the fights double? Like, that just doesn't make sense to me. And yeah. That's my take on the junior game, just from a personal standpoint.
No, and I mean, that's fair. I mean, the math doesn't make sense if that's the idea that we're looking for in terms of having, you know, faster, you know, better hockey, all that kind of stuff at the pro level. Why are we encouraging it at the minor league level?
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
I mean, I got to ask you about that then, because you spoke with Bruce Hamilton. He's the owner of the Kelowna Rockets, for whom, yep, James McEwen, who you just spoke about, where he played. And you described the conversation with Hamilton as being, quote, very old school hockey, unquote. Do we need an institutional change at the ownership and administrative levels for the view on fighting to change in society?
Yes, it's interesting. Like, I hear a lot of people use the term culture shift. I hear people say, you know, do we need to just have fans reject fighting? You know, all these kinds of, and you know, I think those are nice ideas, but they're a bit highfalutin and a bit, it's kind of passing the buck, because really the people who control the way the game is played are the people who own the teams and the commissioners. But I mean, even the commissioners work for the owners, right?
Right, yeah.
So what we need is our owners to step up and say, wait a minute, we've got a fast, beautiful game with passing, shooting, scoring, speed, explosiveness, energy. all those good things. And every once in a while, we stop all that to watch two guys pulverize each other's faces. Okay, that's one thing, but the fans might still like it. But what if the owner stepped forward and had the courage or conviction to say, you know what, I value the people who play not only this sport, but for my company, for my team, and I don't want them to be sick after they finish playing. I don't want them to want to kill themselves, to be in jail, to suffer from addiction, to be estranged from their families. I don't want these things for the people who play the game and for the people who help me earn money and help me, you know, win championships or playoff series. And what I'm going to do is step forward and say, we don't need this anymore. And they did it in the Ontario Hockey League to an extent, right? 3-4 years ago, they brought in the rule that if you fight more than three times in a season, every subsequent fight after three is a two-game suspension. They cut fighting in half in one stroke of a pen. So this is imminently doable. It's doable. It could be done before the start of next season, really. I mean, I'm not saying there would be zero fights, but you could have it down to a couple dozen very, very easily. And it sounds simple, but I know it might be tough to convince these guys, but it just requires the owners to step up, or the commissioner, or whoever has the control of the rules, and say, you know what, we don't want this anymore.
So, I mean, in the book, I think it was great that you started with James McEwen's story, because James McEwen has an outstanding story about, you know, sort of falling into that darkness and then finding a way out of it. And I think that's a good reminder that not all players end up, you know, just stuck in this sort of awful existence after that. But in saying that, in his portion of the book, he describes life as an enforcer in the minors as, quote, the hardest way to make a living, unquote. Yet no one ever seems to talk about that side of the enforcer's role. Do you believe that some of these people, specifically the junior hockey players, as you were mentioning, would change their attitudes about fighting in hockey if they saw how some of these, you know, warriors lived once they hung up their skates?
I would think so. I would hope so. But I feel like those stories are out there. I mean, like when I started writing this book, the main reason I wanted to write it was I told myself, look, there's lots of books that have been written, lots of great books, in fact, that have been written about the enforcers who are dead, who have passed away, the Proberts, the Montadors, the Bougards. But what I wanted to do was document the lives of some enforcers, some former enforcers, while they're still here. And that came with its own challenges. But, of course, a part of that would be hoping that some of these young players would read these stories and think twice about what they're doing. But what I also came to learn through the research and writing up this book is that being a Canadian hockey player who has, you know, excelled to a certain extent and has even a glimmer of hope to reach that great Canadian dream of playing in the NHL in front of 20,000 fans, playing with the greatest in the world, playing with a shot at possibly going to the playoffs and winning a Stanley Cup, that's one hell of a drug. And each guy in my book, they talk about that. They talk about how they assigned their own personal sense of self-worth to how they performed on the ice and what that meant to their friends and their family, their parents, what it meant to them personally to prove that to people on a nightly basis out on the ice. And that's a powerful thing. That's a really powerful thing. That money, that fame, that attaching personal worth to your own athleticism pertaining to a specific sport. And so as much as I would like to think that these stories should at least deter some young players, 10, 20, 30%, I'm not totally convinced, because I think the overriding message that it's okay and that it's safe and that it's no big deal may be stronger than these stories, which surprises me, but it's kind of creeping into my own head as I kind of go through the process of releasing this book and learning how people are responding to it.
It's almost like multi-headed, sort of this multi-headed monster then, in terms of what you're saying. Like, it's institutionalized in hockey. It's sort of reinforced in hockey by this glamour and by this sort of stardom that these guys get. And together, it's almost impossible to separate.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, like, I would like to think that parents would instill in their kids that, like, yeah, sure, like, pursue hockey with the greatest passion in your heart, and let's do it as much as we can, and let's do it as hard as we can for as long as we can. But, like, hopefully there's some tempering of that to say, like, your worth as a person is not connected to the game of hockey. Yeah. I know not everyone has that ability or the nuanced, I don't know, intellectuality to be able to like communicate that to their kids. But I think it is a dangerous thing. And when I got to go know Daniel Carcillo a bit more, who wrote the foreword for the book, you hear these stories and it's like, you can tell it's like they've attached this. It's much more than hockey. It's more than scoring a goal or winning a game. It's being like, no, I matter. I'm a good person who matters, who can prove that on the ice. And then that leaks into like, well, if you don't fight, you might not be able to keep proving that you matter. And so it's like, well, it's not even really a choice. Well, then if I have to fight, I have to fight, right? It's this powerful thing. And so I think you're right. I think we are up against some pretty nefarious and tough forces. But in the end, it has to be people's lives and people's health that matters more and that comes out on top in our equation of how we organize the sport of hockey. So that's just where I'm coming at it from.
No, and I mean, I agree with that. I mean, I'm glad you brought up the do what I have to do sort of attitude that some of these players have to sort of keep their jobs, because McEwen mentioned it in terms of trying to find a job in the BCHL. He got cut by a team and then went over to Merritt and played with them. Got cut by the Trail Smoke Eaters and then went over and got a job with Merritt, where he basically started dropping the gloves and fighting. McEwen's journey to find some of that sort of healing after his days were done went through all sorts of stages and medications, therapies, alcohol, and the drugs to kill the pain while playing. And certainly after he retired, the painkillers certainly helped kill some of that everlasting pain that carried on. Again, not to bring up old stories, but Derek Boogaard, when he was found dead in his hotel room, alcohol and painkillers. It seems a lot of the enforcers get hooked on various substances while trying to fight both the physical and mental pain they're experiencing, caused by the role on the team that they're given. Dale Purinton, another player, former player who you interviewed in the book, got hooked on drugs and alcohol, similar to other players. Bob Probert, notoriously, in terms of his days with the Red Wings. And they did it to kill the pain and the anxiety of fighting during their playing days. So I got to ask you, can totally avoid this question and not try and get in any legal problems here, but I want to know, in your view, should hockey leagues be held accountable for having these players get addicted to substances due to their nature of their roles on their respective teams when it comes to keeping their jobs?
That's a tough one. I don't know. I mean, it seems like a little bit of a stretch, because I don't know that you can always be able to draw that direct A to B line to say,
right, yeah,
because they did this, they ended up with a drug problem. But, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned the word anxiety, because when I talk about some of the uniform parts of these stories, the anxiety is a huge one. Everybody will always tell you, I would check the lineup cards in the morning to see who I was going to have to fight that night. And then, like, that's when the physical anxiety would start manifesting itself. And the people, and, you know, Purinton would tell me he'd go to Detroit. That was Jim Thompson, actually. I interviewed Jim Thompson for the book, too.
Okay.
He fought for the Kings. And he'd say he'd be heading into Detroit, and he'd see Joey Kosher and Bob Probert on the lineup card in the morning. And he would feel physically sick for, like, the rest of the day. And so what do you do to stop that, to have that physical sickness? You drink your face off and take drugs the night before, so you're hungover to the point where when you read the lineup card, it's just kind of like, well, yeah, I feel anxiety, but everything else that's overriding it right now is not as bad. You know, honestly, I don't want to avoid your question. I don't think that's plausible. I think that there is blame to be laid at the foot of hockey, at the foot of the league, at the foot of the teams, for sure. Like, these are tough lives that end up being lived by guys who are in your employ and did a dangerous job. And so I think they need to look themselves in the mirror, and I think they need to be held accountable to a much further extent. But I think it would be probably a little bit simplistic to say, well, if someone ends up being addicted to something, that's the employer's fault. So no to that, but yes to more accountability.
I was looking more for, you know, I think there is some blame to be laid there. And I agree with you. You can't implicitly say, you know, X happens because of Y. But at the same time, though, I just I was reading all of those stories and just going, they all kind of follow the sort of the same path where they get into it, they love the glory, they love the setup, and then all of a sudden there's that turning point where it's like, I got to do this again.
Sure, and you know what? I don't know what the legality of this would be, but maybe, you know, how about this? Maybe if you play in the Western Hockey League or the CHL or the NHL or any league, part of maybe playing, let's say you play two full years or a full season, maybe you just are guaranteed 10 years of addiction services if you ever need it.
That would be good.
You know what I mean? Like that would be a way of taking responsibility for that. And it could just be treated as a proactive thing. Like, look, we know that sometimes this happens. We know it can be scary. We know that 95% of our players will not need this service, but for the 5% who do, it's available to you. Like, I mean, that would probably be pretty progressive and awesome. So, you know, you got me thinking,
well,
yeah, maybe we don't blame them, but maybe the leagues could be more proactive and say, we've seen this happen and we've seen the devastation that can take place. So why not just have this in play? It probably wouldn't cost that much. Of course it would cost, but, you know, the relatively few people who do end up with these issues, it would probably be life-changing. So there's an idea.
I'm thinking maybe not direct comparison between the two programs, obviously, but like the WHL or like the CHL scholarship program where it's available to players who want to use it. Same idea where if you've played X number of years, you can get, you know, say you play 2 years, you have 2 years of you know, possibly addiction or counseling or something along those lines where you can, if you need it, it's there for you.
I like it. Yep.
I read through it twice actually. The chapter that where you went into all the CTE research, talking to the doctors, talking to various experts in the subject. You mentioned before that again, junior players seem to be rather ignorant to the mm-hmm. overall effects of what's going on and how devastating it can be, due to the imperfection basically surrounding the science, that they don't really sort of get that it happens to more. It's happening more and more often. We're discovering more and more often as science gets deeper and deeper into it. How worrisome is it to you that you're hearing these, you know, 16, 17, 18 year old kids go, "Nah, it won't happen to me. It's not a big thing."
Very, very worrisome. I mean, I think there's an element of just, you know, teenage male bravado where you kind of, like, I remember I had it, like, nothing's ever going to happen to me. I'm in
that invincibility,
like,
yeah.
I think that is inherent, but I also think it proves that people or institutions in their life are negligent in properly communicating the devastating impacts that can happen. So I think that was laid stark before me, that if that's actually what they think, and it's not even like, okay, I'm going to be fine. That's one thing. But when people are saying, oh, it's rare, it never happened, like, they clearly don't know what a subconcussive trauma is. Like,
yeah.
You don't have to have a concussion to contribute to the possible future of chronic traumatic encephalopathy. All you need is literally a jolt to your body, and those subconcussive traumas add up just as badly in many cases as concussive traumas.
Yeah.
So there is some nuance there that it's simple nuance, but it's nuance that I don't think is getting through, or I don't think is being communicated in the first place. And that's like one of the first things that you know, these neuroscientists will tell you is that we found that, yes, obviously severe and traumatic brain injuries are brutal and can lead to these kind of degenerative brain diseases. But those little jolts, those, you know, like, for instance, like an offensive lineman, like, yeah, he may not get struck in the head every play, but every time the defensive lineman jolts him with his arms or with his shoulder or with his helmet, that's something. And it's building up, right? So, I mean, I think it should be mandatory that the leagues educate people on this stuff.
Reading the section of Major Misconduct about Stephen Pete and his father, Walter Pete, I found it particularly tough due to everything that sort of happened surrounding Stephen and the relationship with his dad. Hearing Walter, you know, fear for his son's life due to the effects of brain trauma that was a monstrously sobering message to me, just because you hear about everybody else who's sort of gone through these troubles, and now we're hearing it in the present as opposed to in the past. I struggle with it, though, because there are parents that basically sit in every rink that scream for their kids to throw bigger hits and to engage in tougher play. How on earth can we find a happy medium between a violent contact sport and safer place surrounding the brains of athletes?
I mean, the interesting thing about that is one of my most shocking moments of the book was when, outside of obviously the personal stories, was when I asked Dale Purinton, the biggest, toughest, meanest goon possibly of like the whole early 2000s, when I asked him how you get fighting out of hockey, and he said, I asked him, should we take fighting out of hockey? And he said, sure, but first we got to take hitting out. And I just, like, even me, Mr., like, we got to watch out for the player's health,
yeah,
was like, whoa, what? We're going to take body checking out? Like, I honestly hadn't really even thought of that. I had talked to Ken Dryden a bit, and he talked about hits to the head, but even he hadn't said body checking's got to go.
Yeah.
And so to hear Dale Purinton say that, and even, I think the quote was like, I live for this stuff, man. Like, that was my game. I loved it. But we got to slow the game down. We got to, he said, even go a bit more back to like a 90s style clutch and grab. Like, he is kind of saying, he's insinuating that, you know, this faster, more explosive game that we've all been kind of hungering for over the last 10, 15 years is actually something that's feeding some of the injuries because of the speed, because of the level of contact that comes after the speed, right?
Yeah.
And so that was really interesting to me. And so as far as parents, obviously if body checks were out of a professional game, hopefully that would leak down and there would be no body checking in minor sports. But I mean, to address your actual question, I hate to say it, but I think we just need some more humanity, man. Like,
yeah,
we got to stop this, like, win at all costs at every level of the game, every step of the way. My 5-year-old is going to make $1 million playing for the Edmonton Oilers one day or the Winnipeg Jets one day. Like, it's ridiculous. Like, I had an Instagram story sent to me by a buddy the other day, and it was, I think it was from the States too, which usually it's, we're thinking about Canada, but it was like a line brawl, and the dads are laughing. Like, they're like, yeah, look at Taylor go. And I'm just going like, what, like how do we get to this? And so, I mean, first of all, I think parents need to be adults and need to not only respect their own kid and the health of their own kid, but like, look out on that ice and just go like, okay, these are all children playing a sport for fun and fighting and explosive body checks that will injure them is not good, whether it be my kid giving it or getting it. That's not a good thing.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And then I think the rules should punish people more harshly for acts that injure. Like, I think there was a thing in Quebec in a junior game where one of the players just destroyed a goalie who had left the crease, and he got...
Oh, Saskatchewan. That was we actually talked about that on the show a couple weeks ago. It was in Saskatchewan.
Oh, was it Saskatchewan?
Yeah, in the SJHL level. Yeah.
Okay, and knocked all his teeth out, and he you could tell me. I think he got 30 games or something like that.
25 games was the suspension originally. Yeah.
So I mean, 25 seems like a lot, but really that guy shouldn't play again. I mean, why should he play again in that league?
Right.
If you show that wanton disregard for your fellow athlete, for your fellow person, like. I know this is a competition, and I know winning feels great, and I know we've been told that, like basically do anything you can to defeat the other guys, but, like, we gotta let our foot off the gas a little bit on that front and hopefully see each other as fellow athletes and fellow hockey players. But, I mean, again, I think it all comes down to the rules, and if the rules don't suspend enough for acts that hurt, if the rules allow these body checks, if the rules allow these fights, then they're going to keep happening, right? So we have to come from the top, but then hopefully we can scratch the surface of our humanity and start caring about our own kids and the other kids that play against them. I mean, that hopefully doesn't sound like too much of a stretch.
No, I mean, that sounds, to be honest, that sounds human.
there's got to be
some changes made, but I just, again, there has to be major changes made before they sort of trickle down to everybody else, I guess. But I'm concerned only because you've talked to him a few times, obviously, over the course of writing the book and everything. I'm not asking for content of those conversations. There's some major misconduct, but is Steven doing okay? And I'm not, again, I'm not looking for, you know, for an update on where he is and what he's doing. Just is he okay in terms of you still keeping in contact with him and still having conversations with him?
Yeah, we had a long stretch of silence after kind of like the climax of our meeting up after all those months of kind of trying to meet up and trying to chase him down. So after that, I got a message from him that just kind of was a very brief two-sentence message, which was, thanks for talking to me, I'm doing okay. That was pretty shortly after the meeting, and then we didn't talk for a long time, and in the last 2 months, I've been reaching out to him just to say, hey, just so you know, this book is coming out. Can I get you a copy when it comes out? How are you? And I didn't get anything for a while, but then I did hear from him that he's, still alive and kicking in Metro Vancouver here.
Good.
I have to say, I don't have much more detail than that. Literally, I don't.
Yeah.
Just that he's responded to texts, seems like he's doing okay, and I hope he is. I hope he's doing well, because he's a really good guy, and in the good moments I talked to him was just like a buddy, you know, like just a guy that we'd be joking and laughing, and we both grew up in Langley, which, you know, so we know the bars and we know some of the people, and so he's just a good guy that I really do have a soft spot for, and I hope he's doing great.
Well, I mean, you just, the way that you sort of leave off that sort of section with Steven, it kind of leaves that open-ended question of, is he going to be okay kind of set up? So I'm glad to hear that things are going okay for him. He's still answering texts and still responding, so that's
yeah,
a good
again,
sign.
Like,
so.
I would just caution to say, like, I have no idea
mental
health is like. I mean, it might still be really bad, but he is around and responsive, so that's one thing.
Right? The fact that he's still on the right side of the ground is a huge accomplishment, simply because, again, we've heard about other guys that made other choices that didn't result in good things. So I'm happy to hear Steven's doing well in terms of at least, you know, answering texts and certainly responding to your questions anyway, which is good. So
for sure.
I got to say, I mean, I read the Stephen Pete story that you did on the CBC website. It reached a lot of people and certainly reached a lot of people that Pete threw punches against while playing hockey. That brotherhood that's talked about in the book a little bit by Dale Purinton, the brotherhood sort of amongst the enforcers, it seems, still exists, which is great. But in reading some of the responses about from the NHL and the NHL Alumni Association and possibly even the NHLPA in the book, in Major Misconduct, it seems like there's a wide chasm between we're here to help and we can only help if he wants it. I don't know how you bridge that gap. But do you feel that there maybe should be more done by these organizations to maybe help these players transition, not saying just enforcers, but all players, transition out of hockey and back into what we know as quote-unquote normal life?
Yeah, and so I'm not an expert on, like, addiction services and how they work and what's best and what's most progressive and things like that.
Right.
But from my own layman's perspective of having seen the reality of people suffering, living with addiction, like all these guys in the book at one point, and Steven, particularly in those moments, I mean, you know, I had multiple conversations with Glenn Healy, president of the NHL Alumni Association, and I heard it in his voice. He was very sincere, and I think he really does care.
Yeah.
And he promised me that if Steven wants help, he'll get whatever help he needs. And so in that moment, I'm going, okay, that's really good to hear. And it's good to hear someone who's genuine and like, you know, I can't know for sure, but like Glenn really in those moments sounded like he cared, and to the point where we're texting back and forth, oh, have you seen Steven? Like, he cared. I think that's pretty fair to say. But then I go and see Steven and I say, should we call Glenn? And he goes, no, they're going to take me. They're going to put me in a crazy house and I'm going to be away from my family. And I'm just not ready to do that right now. I'm like, okay, well, that's fair enough. That's up to you. But, and you know, obviously you can't have like these like addiction services or whatever, you know, running out and grabbing people out of their car, off the street and like throwing right. them in a car and taking them to the hospital.
Yeah,
like that's infringing on people's rights too. But there has to be some level of outreach to make these things more effective. And yeah, maybe it's not like, hey, you're coming with us right now, but maybe it's just like, we got to go find this guy to have a conversation. we got to go out there with like a sheet of paper that says, if you call this number, someone will come to get you and we will take you there within 2 hours, you know, 2 hours or something like
yeah.
that. Like,
yep.
like I think there has to be some level of like meeting people where they're at, which, you know, I have done a lot of coverage of like the opioid crisis in Vancouver and across Canada. And that's the thing you always hear is like, we got to meet people where they're at. And I think saying to someone, help tier when you're ready to get it, that's not meeting someone where they're at. That's creating a set of obstacles and challenges for someone who's already in a position to not tackle the most basic obstacles in their life. So adding bureaucracy and kind of highfalutin ideas of, oh, am I ready to truly do the work to become sober? Like, those things are, those are tough concepts for people who are in their right mind. And if you're not, yeah. So I just do think there needs to be some sort of outreach in some capacity. Again, I don't know exactly what the best practice is for that, but it has to exist, because otherwise I think that's a bridge too far to just be like, hey, we're here for you, but you got to find us.
Yeah.
Because when I saw Stephen in that moment in that Tim Hortons, when he was really struggling, like, I'll bet you if I said, meet me across the street in 20 minutes, like, he couldn't have.
Right.
And that's not a judgment. That's just what, that was true.
Right.
And so if that's not possible, and he's sure as hell not going to be able to fill out 5 forms, get a ride to whatever, wherever he needs to go, or get on a plane, or, you know, whatever it is, like, just the logistics of it are unfair, let alone the, like, the mental fortitude it would take to, like, make that decision.
I mean, reading that whole thing about, you know, some of the stuff that had happened to Stephen, where, you know, he missed appointments and he missed, you know, other sort of important dates that he had to be at. I mean, I totally understand that he wouldn't be able to meet you in 20 minutes. So, I mean, like I said, that's why I sort of asked about the question previous to that about being concerned about him, you know, is he okay? Like, again, you don't want to see, I mean, we never want to wish harm on anybody or anything bad on anybody, but I mean, to hear some of the struggles he was going through was kind of tough. So, I'm going to reference something you mentioned before. Fighting is down in all leagues statistically. The unfortunate part, though, is that the rate of all concussions still seem to be going up thanks to better science, better understanding of concussions, and, of course, better diagnosis of concussion symptoms. While fighting does promote direct violent contact to the head in terms of bouncing the brain inside the skull, do you agree with Ken Dryden's stance? Again, you can be simple yes or no if you want, but do you agree with Ken Dryden's stance that any and all contact with the head in hockey should be penalized, knowing what we now know about concussions and their overall effects?
Absolutely. And it should be suspended exponentially more harshly, and fined, teams and players.
I don't disagree with you, and I think that's the good part. I know some people are going to rip me for that, but whatever. I'll take the punishment on that, because I agree. If players are getting their bells wrong, as they used to say, getting their bells wrong and not coming back to the game, there should be.
What do hockey players love most? They love playing hockey.
Yes.
So if you take that away from them, they're going to think twice. So I think it's really that simple.
I have yet to reference him because of his polarizing stances on hockey, but former CBC personality Don Cherry has a long history of promoting toughness in hockey and, quote, playing the right way through years of hockey traditions that we now know are virtually and simply archaic in nature. Do you find it hard to have Cherry promoted and featured on national broadcasts when his version of hockey seemingly no longer has a place in today's game?
I mean, I've been ignoring Don Cherry for at least a decade.
Okay.
I think he is one of the most single damaging, devastating, dangerous figures in Canadian sport history. I think he has done more than anyone else to spread the untrue idea of two people fighting and everyone's fine. What is it? See their kids, two good guys going at it, yep. Nobody gets hurt.
Yeah.
That is a lie that he has perpetuated for decades. And every single person I've spoken to who's become a hockey fighter has mentioned that. Rock'em Sock'em videos and Coach's Corner. And, he's on an age, Don Cherry, but he has a lot to answer for. He won't. He's unaccountable. He thinks he's above it. But this is a man who has a role in the devastation of the lives of hockey players. He should answer for it. And I think at the end of the day, he has no place on TV, in the media. He should be seen as a person who spreads a dangerous message of pain. And, yeah, I don't have much time for him.
Nope. And that's, I mean, that's fair. I mean, like I said, I mean, seeing the work you've done with these three players, with Dale Purinton, with James McEwen, with Stephen Pete. I mean, these are guys that were got, you know, that were promoted on a lot of these Rock'em Sock'em, or guys like them anyway, were promoted on Rock'em Sock'em Hockey. And I don't disagree with you in terms of that side of it for sure. So,
sorry, I gotta go, man.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no. I was gonna say one final question. I was just gonna ask you because it's a fun question just to finish off with, because I think it's a great story. He seems like he's doing extremely well. So I got to know. James McEwen took you to one of his Kundalini yoga classes. Did you participate?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And did McEwen convince you to continue to practice afterwards?
Well, you know what? I'd done yoga a bunch before. I mean, remember, I am from Vancouver.
Yeah, it's
like
true. Yeah,
a part of your Vancouver license to have tried yoga a couple times. Kundalini is kind of like next level with the fire breath, and it's a bit more. I don't know, what would you call it? Like flowery in its language, and it's a bit more spiritual and stuff like that. I really enjoyed the class especially because of the music part of it. But nope, I am not a Kundalini yoga practitioner, but I think it was super important to be there with him and to understand his practice and to see the impact, and also that powerful juxtaposition of, you know, former fighter now preaching the kind of deep ancient tenets of peace. So it was a very cool experience, but not my cup of tea.
That's all right then. That's kind of cool. We are going to let you get out of here then, because like I said, I didn't want to take up too much of your time. I know we're a little bit over time already. But ladies and gentlemen, Jeremy Allingham, the author of the new book coming out, Major Misconduct, The Cost of Human Fighting in Hockey, an outstanding book. And if you are not convinced that hockey doesn't need to be taken out of hockey, or fighting doesn't need to be taken out of hockey yet, definitely get this book, take a read, and then maybe cast another opinion after that, after you read some of the stuff that some of these players have gone through. Jeremy, I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us today and giving us this great interview. All the best. I hope you blow sales out of the water. You're a top, you know, you're on the New York Times top selling list and all that kind of stuff or whatever. But really, the book is outstanding, and I can't thank you enough for giving us a little bit of time today.
Thanks for having me. The research that went into it, and thanks for reading it, and thanks for your time.
Yeah, not a problem. I will have a review up on Hockey Blog in Canada this week as well, so for anybody looking to, if you're not sure about the book, definitely tune in for that and check that out on the website. Jeremy Allingham, catch him on CBC as well, where he is an award-winning journalist. Thanks again, Jeremy.
Thanks, Trevor. Have a good one.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
It's a lot to do it for Jeremy Allingham in terms of having him on, but a very... very tough discussion about hockey fighting, and certainly the life after hockey that some of these enforcers go through, a lot of the head trauma, a lot of the concussions, a lot of the what looks like could be symptoms of CTE in a lot of these players who come out. Skippy in here in the studio with me right now. I know you were doing some other work, Skippy. I don't know how much of the interview you heard, but it's a scary future for some of these guys.
But does he just focus on the fighters, or just in general? Because
just for this book, he focused on the guys that were fighting. But at the same time, though, he's saying that, I mean, there are some chapters in the book that do deal specifically only with, you know, the science of CTE and how head trauma, and again, you can get that from, as you were going to say, body checks, hits,
body,
you know,
checks,
that kind of
right.
stuff, you know, even falls, even
no,
just general.
There's no real fighting in football, but football is the right. big CTE because of how, you know, bodily contact the sport that is. And so it's not about the fighting, it's about the ball, you know, the impact.
Right. I think the scariest thing, and he mentioned it, is that when he spoke to the junior hockey players, how they sort of just disregard the science because it's not really, you know, mainstream at this point in terms of how the science works.
And I think the age of junior players sort of represent a sort of stereotypical of a younger generation who is more dismissive because the wisdom and the maturity isn't there to look at something, you know.
And Jeremy, I mean, alludes to that sort of air of invincibility that these kids have, right? Like, you know, the one guy who said, you know, he led the league in fights last year, and he said, well, you know, I don't have to worry about it because my head is hard. It's one of those things where you kind of go, that's a nice sentiment to have, but
anything is hard until you hit it enough times to soften it up.
And again, we're talking about if your head is hard, what's your brain doing on the inside bouncing off that skull, right? Like, that's where I kind of go, I don't know about this. But it's a tough, tough read if you're going to get the book, Major Misconduct. I reviewed it in a hockey blog in Canada. You can find it from last Saturday. I think I put the review up after I spoke to Jeremy. I made sure I went home and did the review on it. It's a very sobering look that Stephen Pete, the section on Stephen Pete, just to give you an idea, Stephen Pete, who was, again, named one of the toughest guys in the NHL, was up there in terms of fighting majors, was pound for pound willing to go with anybody in the NHL, the Bob Proberts, the Ty Domies, the Joey Koshers, the toughest guys that we remember anyway from that era. Stephen Pete is now living in his truck, doesn't have a home. Doesn't have a fixed permanent address. Stephen Pete lives in his truck because he's run into so many problems due to, you know,
behavior.
Some of it's behavior. Some of it, again, and the story in the book, and this is where Jeremy Allingham really tells a good story. He was loves working on things like stereos on electronics, that kind of stuff. Stephen couldn't find his soldering iron, so he was actually using a blowtorch to try and, you know, solder some stuff together, get it hot enough to sort of melt the solder onto the circuit board. Put the blowtorch down, not paying attention, wandered away to the kitchen to go get something to drink, came back, and the entire room was engulfed in flames because he left he put it too close to, I believe, the curtains that were in the...
I guess you could say attention is part of behavior.
Well,
the
problem is that the insurance company then said it was arson, so he can't get an apartment, he can't get a room at a housing complex because he's now labeled as an arsonist. He's now been found guilty as being an arsonist, and because he keeps missing probationary meetings and probation dates because he can't remember the dates because his memory has just been basically eliminated. He routinely finds himself in jail. And you kind of go, this is not the way that a feared competitor, that a fierce competitor in the NHL should be living out his days in terms of bouncing in and out of jail.
I'm trying to remember the hockey player that TSN had
Todd Ewan, his wife, yeah.
He was wandering in homeless in a park.
Right.
I think in BC or...
Oh, that could be Stephen Pete, actually. Stephen, they did a feature on...
No, it was somebody else.
Okay, I was going to say...
Who had a longer NHL career, who might have actually been a cup winner. I'm trying to...
Yeah, Todd Ewan won in 93 with the Montreal Canadiens. Yeah.
I think it was him, right.
So, I mean...
I think there might have been somebody else, too. I've heard a couple of stories like that where it's like they were NHL regulars and now it's like, where are they now? They're homeless,
right?
And it's like nobody's heard from them, and including former you know, stars who are their teammates in the NHL who are, you know, not in the same, don't have the same path.
Yeah.
And I just can't believe that they went one way and their former teammate and went the other way. And it's like, that could have been them.
Well, and that's the scary part, I think, because you mentioned the football players in terms of having CTE and they've done, you know, examinations on the brains and opened it up and they've, you know, they've looked pretty scary in terms of the amount of damage that they've done to their brains. But I mean, you hear about some of the football players that have, you know, they have these violent mood swings. They have these indiscretions where they just go and do something that is completely out of character. And that's Stephen Pete to a large degree. Dale Purinton talks about it as well. He has an incident in New York City where he does that.
I never saw the movie, the Will Smith movie, the concussion movie.
Yeah,
but you know, football being a repetitive play kind of where hockey is not necessarily repetitive. You're not getting hit at the same time at the same regular intervals at the same position. You're moving around and you're randomly hitting, but every game you're hitting multiple times.
Yeah.
But in football, it's same repetitive from the very beginning. So then that escalates to the, by the time you start, you've already escalated the condition compared to the other impact sports,
right,
like hockey being the most obvious. But I mean, it would happen in I assume in a smaller level in basketball and even soccer, football.
Yeah. Soccer, there's a high prevalence of concussions only because of the amount of times that you're using your head to play the ball. That's one of the studies that they have for that. So,
well, if you've watched soccer, it's high con. I mean,
oh, no, there's contact and stuff.
A lot
yeah.
more contact and falling. So the contact is there. In the same like basketball, the contact is there. The picks and the, you know, it's just not at the consistent level that football is. That's why football gets the attention.
Yes, for sure. Yeah.
It's the one. Again.
A tough story, definitely a tough read, but one that I think that people should pick up and definitely check out. If you're looking for a holiday gift, it's a fantastic read. It's a tough, again, I'm not going to lie, it's a sobering, tough read to read about how these three players kind of went down this path, thought that fighting was going to get them into the NHL. For two of them, it did. For McEwen, James McEwen went to the ECHL, fought a bunch of tough guys there. But they were, again, glamorized. The glory was there. The guys loved doing it. And then when they get out of hockey, they realize that they've put their life at risk in terms of doing this. So, there's some good stories in there. There's some silver linings into the dark clouds that Jeremy Allingham brings up in Major Misconduct. But again, you want to pick up that book if you want to
look, think of it as an eye opener.
Yeah. And that's what it is.
You don't know enough.
It's enough that it should make you aware that there are inherent dangers with fighting in hockey, obviously, but with the way that the game is being played as well. So happy to have Jeremy on. Again, pick up his book, Major Misconduct, at your local bookstore. It's an outstanding read. I highly recommend it. In saying that, next week, folks, happy to have a number of people coming into the show. We're going to be joined by members of the Jet-Centric podcast. You may have heard of the Jet-Centric podcast. If you're on Twitter, you certainly may know it if you're a Jets fan. Outstanding to have those gentlemen on. We're going to see if we can maybe squeeze a couple more special guests in if we can. Going to do a Jets roundtable next week, folks. We're going to talk about everything that's going on. Obviously, today there
is available. If you want
Skip,
to drop
Skippy,
by
if you want to jump into the conversation, you're more than welcome to join us next week as well. We'd be happy to have you. But again, going to be a lot of news that came out from Jets World today. We'll look at what happens when they get back off the road trip. Obviously, they'll wrap up this West Coast road trip. They've played most of the teams in their conference. I guess they played a few Eastern Conference teams there, but we'll look at the Jets. We'll discuss the Jets. We'll talk everything Jets next week as we get into that. So the Jets roundtable will happen next week. Happy to have everybody aboard from the Jet-Centric podcast. We'll talk to them, meet them, and certainly give them a little promotion as well. Also going to mention that next week we will announce the winners of the prize packs for the Bisons as well. We got a few people that won prize packs for the Bisons here on the hockey show in terms of what we gave away last week during Pledgerama. And for everybody who contributed, we are up to $44,568, folks. I cannot say thank you enough for your generous support of the station, of the show, of every other show on here as well. That is an outstanding number, folks, and we cannot do it. That antenna is going up, number one. Number two, we might be able to upgrade the antenna in terms of getting the fancy one with jewels and diamonds. And
I did everything. Just has to work.
Exactly. But in saying that, though, folks, we couldn't do it without you. Antenna will go up. Thank you for everything and for all your contributions this year. $44,568 is an outstanding number. Thank you again for that. Going to get out of here. Skippy's coming in right away with his show.
Big Halloween show, themed show, some music, some clips.
Good. Be fun. That'll be fun.
Big tease for next week's Jets show.
Oh.
Deebs, what is your short yes or no prediction? Are the Jets season done? Yes or no? It's a tease for next week.
No, I'm going to say no, and I'll get into it next week as to why. I know we discussed it a little bit off the air before the show started, but I'm going to say no. I think there's some good to still come out of this season, but we'll talk about that next week.
Next week, right here, Hockey Show.
Look at that. Good setup by you. With that, going to get out of here. Here's a little more Donovan as we played that off the top here, Season of the Witch. You're hearing it live here on the Hockey Show on 101.5. See you next week, everybody, for the Jets Roundtable here on the Hockey Show.